a two-part series entitled Shalom, the Story of a Biblical Word. I'm sure that many of you have heard that word shalom and may or may not connect with it certain meanings. You probably know that some people have eagerly chosen this word and are using it to represent something, to be a symbol for something. And it may be clear to us sometimes what exactly it stands for, and sometimes it is not. Be that as it may, today and tomorrow, I would like to explore with you what the Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, the early Christian writings, and the writings of the early rabbis have to say on that word shalom. I have consciously not translated it. Evidently, it is not an English word. I have simply said it the way in which it is said in Hebrew. Actually, you will soon find that translating the word is not altogether easy. As so often in translation, one language does not exactly coincide with another language in the way in which it describes what it sees. The more abstract, the more complex a word is, the more you get difficulties in translating a word. Sometimes you can translate a given Hebrew word in the Old Testament, or for that matter, a Greek word in the New Testament, with 9 or 10 different English words. It all depends on the context. Therefore, it is not a sign of a good translation that it always translates the same Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek word with the same English word. No, changes take place, and anyone who uses contemporary translations that are sensitively done by people who know both the original tongues and modern English will discover that one and the same word may be translated very differently from text to text. You may also discover that when you lay 2 or 3 modern translations side by side, and you will find that often they use quite different wording. Now, this is, of course, not to suggest that one or the other translation is not faithful. No, this has something to do with semantics. That is a technical term that refers to the science or to the knowledge, to the inquiry into how words mean what they mean, what's going on in signification. But don't be afraid, I don't intend to go now into the details of semantics with you. I would need a much bigger blackboard, for one thing. Let us focus on this particular word. Now, for clarity's sake, I have divided my presentations, 2 of them, today and tomorrow, into 3 parts, which the occurrences of this word shalom in the Old Testament and its New Testament equivalent, eirene, a Greek word, suggests to me. First, I would like to discuss with you more broadly the parameters, the horizons, the stage on which these two words, shalom and eirene, operate. I would like to show you how far they can go, what they can do and what they cannot do, what their synonyms are, what their antonyms are, what their ranges of possible use is. Because the word shalom occurs in the Old Testament approximately 240 times. That's quite a bit. And the word eirene, its equivalent, occurs in the New Testament approximately 90 times. That's also quite a bit. It's, by the way, roughly the same distribution pattern in both. That's what I would like to discuss with you today, briefly under the heading Horizons of Shalom. Then I would like to discuss with you the depth of shalom. Here I will focus on the Old Testament. In fact, I could have written in parentheses behind the second section here, the Old Testament evidence. and you have the texts I would like to discuss with you written in the lower third of the blackboard, but that has to wait for a little while. And then thirdly, and that will come tomorrow, I will interpret the evidence from the early Christian writings and from the early rabbis, the contemporaries of Jesus, the Jewish teachers of his time, under the heading Centers of Shalom. But now, to let the secret out of the bag, if indeed it still is a secret, the word shalom is commonly translated with our English word peace. Now, you will learn in the course of my presentations that to a certain extent this is a very justified translation, that indeed already the ancient translators of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, used very consistently a Greek word, eirene, which we commonly translate with peace. But you will also discover from my presentations, or should I rather say from the texts we will read together, that you have to push outward the limits of the English word peace so that it can comprehend, cover the meanings of the Hebrew and Greek words. I already indicated to you that the word occurs in the Old Testament approximately 240 times. Now, mind you, statistical observations in themselves cannot carry us very far. There are quite a few words that occur thousands of times in the Old Testament and yet are of relatively little significance. The word "and" occurs thousands of times. But who would discuss at great length that fact, that it occurs so often? What is more important is the observation that when a word occurs around 240 times, give take a few, we cannot pin it down exactly because in some places the Hebrew text is not altogether clear and we don't even know whether we are dealing with this particular word, hence this little uncertainty at the edges. When a word occurs 240 times, then you ask, does it occur everywhere in the Hebrew scriptures? And the answer is a qualified yes. It does occur, scattered fairly evenly through the Old Testament, through the Hebrew scriptures. It does not occur so much in the wisdom writings, in the book of Proverbs, in Job and Ecclesiastes, just a very few times. It does occur regularly in the first five books of the Old Testament, in the Torah, in the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It occurs then in an even smattering through the historical books. And you would expect it in the prophetical books. It does occur quite a bit. You see that one, two, three of the passages I have on the blackboard come from the prophetical books. And this reflects the fact that the prophetic voices of ancient Israel did speak with some emphasis on shalom. The same distribution pattern one can observe in the intertestamental writings, in other words, those Jewish writings which were considered sacred by some groups of the Jews, but not by enough groups of the Jews to make it into the canon of the Old Testament. It occurs roughly with the same distribution pattern in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then again in the writings of the early rabbis. In fact, the last passage to which I refer here in the very right lower bottom of the blackboard is one of these rabbinic passages to which I will return later. The same, by the way, is true of the New Testament. It occurs in all the writings of the New Testament if you take the three letters of John as one unit, which many of you know is a fair thing to do. So again, you have here an even distribution. And when you then move into the writings of the early Christian church after the time of the New Testament, you observe the same. You find it in the writings of the apostolic fathers. These are early Christian writings from the end of the first century running through the second century that were highly esteemed by the early Christians and were considered almost as important as the New Testament. You then discover it in the writings of the church fathers. And when you come to St. Augustine, around AD 400, you discover that he, in his very famous and voluminous work on the City of God, almost his systematic theology, has a whole book, book 19, devoted to the notion of pax. Pax, as you see, is the Latin equivalent of shalom eirene, peace. So you see, it has exercised already the writers of the Old Testament, and it continued to be an important theme for the early rabbis and for the early Christians. Indeed, these horizons are very wide ones, you must admit. Now let me add a second consideration to all this. When you take the concordance and look through these 240 occurrences of the word in the Old Testament, you discover that in meaning, the word also ranges far and wide. For instance, you get this sort of use of the word shalom. One person meets another on the road. They know each other, and he asks him, or she asks her, Ma shalomcha? Translated, how is your shalom? Now don't overload that word. It simply means, how are you today? Or maybe just, good morning. The word shalom was and still is the common greeting. You have many occurrences of that word in the Old Testament that show that the word was used as a very ordinary day word, saying good morning, good day, good evening, how are you, or farewell. Many. Interesting, by the way, is that this usage is attested especially at the beginning of letters. You would begin a letter with the word shalom. Now, it is a greeting, but as you know, a greeting is much more than two or three words that you customarily say and that are almost like worn down coins. A greeting really establishes or reestablishes a human relationship. You tune in to each other, and you may then continue the encounter with a conversation that goes much more into depth, or you may let it go at that. In either case, this word has established a relationship or reconfirmed it. But no doubt, this is a very ordinary use. How much we must translate it as, how are you? How do you fare? Is illustrated in an almost ironic way in the 11th chapter of the second book of Samuel. Actually, you have to follow fairly closely now my argumentation, it's not long. When Uriah comes home, ordered home, the whole sordid story you can read for yourself in the 11th chapter of 2 Samuel, it's that of David and Bathsheba, and you know that David wanted to cover up the adultery by ultimately having Uriah killed. It's in this context that Uriah comes home, a high officer of David, from the war. He meets David, and David asks him, what is your shalom? Standard greeting, how are you? What is the shalom of Joab, the field commander out in the field? What is the shalom of the war? You see how the word shalom simply means how something is faring. That's a somewhat extreme example, but a striking one. So on the one hand, you see the word shalom used in ordinary, everyday language, and you must not overly freight it, load it with meaning. On the other hand, you have some texts in the Old Testament, not to mention the New and the early rabbis, who speak of peace, of shalom, in a very concentrated theological fashion. For instance, the unknown prophet whose words we hear in the book of Isaiah, chapters 40 through 55, can say that God's covenant of peace will never depart from Israel, shall always stand. That's in the 55th chapter of the book of Isaiah. And we hear time and again the word shalom used in a very freighted, loaded sense, almost like one of these heavy theological words that we preachers like to throw around. But of course, it's much more serious than that. Here, the experience of a religious community has become condensed, has become very concentrated. And I suspect it is because of that that the word shalom is such a favorite today with many people. One more thing that I need to say under heading number one, the horizons of shalom. What are the synonyms of shalom in the Old Testament? What its antonyms? But let me explain that question first. You know that many good preachers will say what they have to say, not just once. That may be too fast. It may slip by you. So the good speaker will repeat what he or she has to say by saying it again in a different way. If he or she were to say it in the same words, you would quickly get bored and switch off, right? But if he or she uses synonyms, puts the same thing in other words, looks at it from a different perspective, yet focuses on the same matter, it becomes much easier to follow. You understand it much more readily. You see it, so to speak, three-dimensionally. By the same token, if you want to teach well, you not only teach what you have to teach, but you clarify it by saying, now, this is what I would like to teach you, and this is what it is. Now, this would be the opposite. This would be the contrast. This and this is what I do not mean. In other words, it's a very old principle employed by good writers and good speakers to unfold something, to develop it, to explain it by using synonyms and antonyms. Footnote, in tight scholarly debate and argument, this is usually not done. You move point A, point B, point C, point D. If you can't follow, too bad for you. But that's not the game in which we are engaged at this point. So let me return now to my question. What are the synonyms, what are the antonyms for shalom? A great many occur. And we can answer that question with such confidence because the poetry of the ancient Hebrews and most of the words of the prophets are written in poetry. The wisdom literature, of course, is written in poetry. Because the poetry of the ancient Hebrews had a very peculiar feature that strikes us moderns as somewhat odd, but is well known to any student of the Old Testament. It was discovered very clearly 200 years ago on the European continent by an outstanding scholar of literature. Herder was his name, and at the same time by an English scholar of the scriptures, the Bishop Loth of London. What is that discovery? That discovery is that the poetry of the ancient Hebrews has a very interesting way of being poetry. It's not meter or rhyme or strophes, even though all of these occasionally occur. No, the most characteristic sign is that whatever the poet or the prophet wishes to say, he or she will say in parallel lines. Listen to this. A good son is the delight of his father, an obedient daughter the happiness of her mother. You recognize that this is very much biblical style that you encounter, this particular example, in the book of Proverbs. This way of speaking in parallel lines is very typical for Hebrew poetry. It may also run this way. A disobedient son is the disgrace of his father, an obedient daughter the delight of her mother. How many thoughts are expressed there? Really only one. But it is expressed doubly. It is expressed first negatively and then positively. But lest I go off into a lecture on Hebrew poetry and what makes Hebrew poetry, suffice it to say that this parallel arrangement that you encounter in the poetry of the Old Testament allows us to collect a great many synonyms, because the thought expressed in the one line, line number one, will be repeated in synonyms or antonyms, as the case may be, in the second line. So we are really in business when we ask the question, what are the synonyms, what are the antonyms of shalom in the Old Testament? Well, a great many, so many that I cannot keep them all in my head, and I'm here referring to a publication of the seminary where I serve. It's entitled Explore, a Journal of Theology. It is published by Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, and we devote each issue to a specific concern, contemporary concern, or sometimes also a scholarly concern that is not necessarily highly relevant or modern or contemporary. A seminary has to have the courage both to be out of date and to be in date, I think. It should be neither completely out of date nor so relevant and modern that it forgets its roots. Now here in an issue on peace, we consider some of the contemporary peace issues. By the way, several copies are available in the bookstore. Now at the end, we have an article entitled Reflection, in which I discuss the language of peace in the Bible, Shalom and Eirene, so that you know from where I get my wisdom. Here I list on page 70 the various synonyms and antonyms for the word. I say here, quote, their semantic range is defined by words which are synonymous, such as good and healing, Jeremiah 8:15, life, Malachi 2:5, security, 2 Kings 20:19, comfort, Isaiah 66:12 13, joy, Isaiah 55:12, even steadfast love and righteousness, Isaiah 54:10, and another passage. Let me repeat them without the references to the texts. Good, healing, life, security, comfort, joy, steadfast love, righteousness. All these can be synonyms of the word shalom. And you sense here something of the wide semantic range, the wide horizons of meaning of this word. The blessing of Aaron, which is found in Numbers 6, 24 through 26, the Aaronite blessing, which especially in some Lutheran liturgies is the standard way of concluding the service. I grew up with it. Emma speaks of giving people peace in the context of various other synonyms. You may check that for yourself. What are the antonyms of the word peace in the Old Testament? In other words, words that mean the opposite of peace, because if we get to know these, we get a still fuller understanding of what the word shalom means. The word terror can be the opposite of peace. Or the affliction of a people that is bereft of peace. King Hezekiah can speak of the great bitterness that has overcome him, and he contrasts it with the shalom, the peace, the security for which he had hoped. There is no peace for the evildoer, a proverbial phrase affirms. Life in peace is fully described in an epilogue to the Holiness Code, one of the several law codes of the Old Testament found in the book of Leviticus 17 through 26, where peace is fully described as a time and a place where rains come in their season, the land yields its increase, there is freedom from fear, victory over enemies, fertility of the womb and of animal and of the field, and most of all God's presence among his people. All these are the marks of peace. Leviticus 26, 3 through 13. Now, before I conclude this first section here, Horizons of Shalom, let me reflect with you for a moment on the Greek word that is commonly translated, that commonly translates the Hebrew word shalom. I already noted that it is interesting that the ancient translators of the Old Testament into Greek before the time of Jesus, now please mark this, that the ancient translators of the Old Testament into Greek for the use of Greek-speaking Jews, by then scattered across the ancient world, very consistently employ the Greek word eirene for the Hebrew word shalom. Now when you check into the standard big dictionaries of the classical Greek language, you discover that the word eirene has a somewhat different shade of meaning in comparison to shalom. Shalom, you see, is a very active word. It is well-being. It is hope. It is security. It is something that human beings do, for which they strive, which they lament when they don't have it. The Greek word eirene has a more passive flavor to it. In fact, the best translation of the word eirene for ancient classical Greek that lies long before the time of the New Testament and the Septuagint is really a state of not being disturbed, of being at rest. Indeed, that is the best translation for the classical Greek term eirene. Now, and I cannot sketch this fully in this context, as the Hebrew scriptures move into the larger world of the ancient Hellenistic and Roman empires, encounter the classical Greek culture, and as they are translated into the Greek language, the search set in for the right word to translate the Hebrew word shalom. And it was the word eirene that was chosen. And those who have studied this matter more deeply point out that here the word shalom in a way becomes somewhat, but note my word somewhat, deflected. It has added to it this element of rest, being at rest, this more passive element of the Greek word. But I notice the discussion becomes a little bit complex. Suffice it to note that both for the early rabbis, in as far as they spoke Greek, and many of them of course did, and for the early Christians, the Greek word eirene served more like a vessel, like a jar, into which then the meaning of the Hebrew word shalom was poured. And so many interpreters of the New Testament can flatly state that when we read the word eirene, peace, in the New Testament, and we read it a lot, we really have to see behind it the Hebrew word shalom. Indeed, I think this is the case, all the more so since in the early Christian period after the New Testament, the original meaning of eirene begins to assert itself. And when you read St. Augustine, you wonder whether you talk about shalom in the Hebrew sense or eirene in the classical Greek sense. But that's a matter for my colleagues in patristics to discuss. And it's a very interesting discussion indeed. And by the way, would lead on into the discussion of peace and war by the Christian churches through the ages right down to the present time. But this is not my primary concern at this point. So far for heading number one, Horizons of Shalom. Now, our time is not quite up, and I would like to get into point number two, but don't have to if you have questions to ask. You all seem to agree. Well, the teacher proceeds. The depth of shalom. Now you may wonder why I have given this title for that second section. Horizons of Shalom, in the light of what I said, I think is clear to you why I've entitled this. Well, for that I now have to turn to some Old Testament passages. Now the first one to which I turn is familiar to you. It is found in the 9th chapter of the book of Isaiah. It is one of the famous quote-quote messianic prophecies, one that is very much read and cherished in the time of Advent and Christmas. But for the time being, I ask you to set the Christian use, the very legitimate and by us much cherished use of that passage aside for the time being. Right now we would like to hear that word of the prophet Isaiah or one of his disciples, as the case may be, as the ancient Hebrews heard it 700 years before Christ. I begin with verse 2, but then skip to 6 and 7. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Many interpreters think that it refers to tribes of Israel who at that time were oppressed if not altogether subjugated by the Assyrians, these very cruel, violent, strong overlords who had flooded the whole world from their home in northern Mesopotamia. Their capital was Nineveh. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. A change has come over them. Note how the prophet speaks in the past tense. He does not speak of the future. He speaks of an event that has just taken place. Light has dawned upon them, dwellers in a land as dark as death. And then let me read a few of the intervening lines so that it's altogether clear. Thou hast increased their joy and given them great gladness. The translation I use, by the way, is that of the New English Bible. They rejoice in thy presence as men rejoice at harvest, as they are glad when they share out the spoil. For thou hast shattered the yoke that burdened them, the collar that lay heavy on their shoulders. Now, if this interpretation is correct, to which I earlier refer, then this great event that has taken place is that they have been freed from oppression, from the subjugation by the Assyrian enemy. Now, if this interpretation is correct, to which I earlier refer, then this great event that has taken place is that they have been freed from oppression, from the subjugation by the Assyrian enemy. All the boots of trampling soldiers and the garments fouled with blood shall become a burning mass, fuel for fire. That refers to the standard custom of burning whatever is left on the battlefield. And then it goes on, New English Bible translation, for a boy has been born for us, a son given to us, to bear the symbol of dominion on his shoulder. A boy has been born, or in other translation, a child has been born, evidently a male child, a son given. To what does that refer? Does it refer to a birth of a royal prince? But if so, how can the birth of a royal prince change the cruel reality of enemy oppression? We are somewhat puzzled, are we not? Mind you, but then we remember from Psalm 2 that in ancient Israel, the birth of a son was also understood as the coronation of a new king. That's in fact what Psalm 2 speaks about. It's the anointing coronation ritual of the new king in Jerusalem. And then the word son is not to be understood literally, but metaphorically, the king as the son of God. All this is very clear when you read Psalm 2. In other words, the great event that changes everything is that a new king has come to the throne in Jerusalem and that he has already accomplished throwing off the yoke of the Assyrians, that he has turned the tide. If you understand it in that way, it begins to make sense. To bear the symbol of dominion on his shoulder, and he shall be called in purpose wonderful, in battle godlike, father for all time, prince of peace. And that's of course why I read this passage with you, because here the word shalom, peace, occurs. It occurs in a series of titles of the new king. Now, to make a long story short, most interpreters think that what we have here is part of the coronation ritual of the king in Jerusalem. The king, when he ascended the throne and was anointed and given the royal diadem, form of crown, was also given royal honorary titles. And here you have four of them all piled together. This is a custom that evidently was widespread in ancient Egypt, and so we think also then in Jerusalem. After all, there were many connections between Egypt and Israel. Let me only remind you that Moses was brought up at the royal court in Egypt. To make a long story short, many interpreters think that the honorary title Prince of Peace and the others which are mentioned here really show that ancient Israel, the kings in Jerusalem, were like other kings of the ancient world, who were eminently the guarantors of justice, of well-being, and of peace. That was the role of the king in the ancient world. He was not primarily supreme justice, judge, even though he was that too. He was not primarily the leader of his armies, even though occasionally he would do that too. No, the king was much more. The king was almost like a channel through which the healing, life-giving powers which the gods, the divine sphere, give to the human sphere are channeled. The king is the medium that through which the gods, or in the case of Israel, the God of Israel, imparts, gives welfare, healing, wholeness, peace to his people. The kings are the guarantors, are the custodians, the guardians of that peace, that welfare, that good, that healing, that steadfast love. I'm simply repeating the synonyms you have heard, through which God upholds his people. And if this is so, most interpreters here speak of the royal ideology of the ancient Near East, which we encounter quite a few times in the Old Testament itself, but that many times in ancient writings from ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, and ancient Syria-Palestine. Then we observe here how also for ancient Israel, shalom, peace, is not a two-dimensional, superficial term, but is deeply charged, has three or more dimensions to it. The word shalom has many meanings, has many relationships. It is an eminently social term. It refers to how human beings relate to each other, to how kings relate to their people, to how the gods or the divine relates to the human sphere. Ancient Israel, in that respect, shared in the culture of the ancient Near East. That's where I stop for today, because the next text that we will discuss tomorrow shows that this became very clear, unambiguously clear, to one of the great prophets of the Old Testament, who then, in the name of Shalom, protested against the all too superficial affirmations of Shalom that he heard bandied all about. But for that, tomorrow. Thank you.